Ruth chapter 3. Tell me a little bit about where we've been. Chapter 1 and 2. Where we've been.
Moab and Bethlehem.
That's it, yeah, just Moab and Bethlehem. Thanks for setting the geographical context, Adolf. I appreciate that. So he's got that covered. Where else we've been?
A bunch of people died. A woman went back to Bethlehem and Ruth met Boaz. And he's a good guy.
Yeah, we looked at this idea. We looked at the different strengths, different character traits of Boaz and Ruth. Kind of looked through it, at it through a dating lens of relationships. What else have you seen in there so far? When we talk about God's hand, God's providence, what have you seen so far in the story of where God's hand is in the details? Yeah.
I think the author of Ruth uses this phrase, like, it so happened.
Mm-hmm.
Really, it's kind of pointing to, like, it didn't just so happen. Like, it's very much in providence of, like, the famine happening and then God restoring food back to the people. And then, like, at that time, the barley harvest started happening, and that's mm-hmm. when they went back, and it just so happened that she ended up in Boaz's field. So, like, that God's providence is overarching over it.
Mm-hmm. That's such a good observation, this idea of, it seems like the author is just subtly slipping in this idea of it just so happened. Almost like ironically saying, you know, we would see this as coincidence, but really we know it's the hand of God. And so I think we talked about this, that saying that coincidences are God's way of remaining anonymous. So it's you see God's hand when you're looking for it. But yeah, this idea of the author of Ruth seems to be showing us God is working, even though Naomi may not even be seeing it yet. So with that, let's jump into chapter 3. So the barley harvest is coming to a close. So we talked about it's about 6 to 7 weeks the harvest is. We're not sure how much Ruth and Boaz have interacted since these initial meetings, but now we know it's coming to a close, and so the opportunity for them to interact and be together is coming to a close. And so we're going to see here Naomi steps in and wants to make something happen. So somebody take verses 1 through 5 of chapter 3.
Boaz, our relative, with whose young women you were. See, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. Wash, therefore, and anoint yourself, and put on your cloak and go down to the threshing floor. But do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. But when he lies down, observe the place where he lies. Then go and uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what to do. And she replied, all that you say I will do.
Awesome, thanks. So what does Naomi step in and do? What's she trying to do here?
Hook him up.
Yeah, try to hook him up. That's right. Yeah, she kind of reminds me, you know, every church has a few of those ladies that, like, identifies the single people in the church and tries to match them up and kind of, hey, you see that girl over there? Or, you know, 7 p.m. service, there's some nice guys there. You should go check it out. It's a little bit of what Naomi's doing here. She's like, all right, I want to see that you're well taken care of. I mean, you see a neat part of Naomi's heart here. She wants to see that her daughter-in-law is well taken care of. She would love to see her family line continue, and she sees this opportunity coming to a close. And so what's her advice to Ruth? Uncover his feet, yeah. So I don't want to be edgy or like shock value just for shock value, but there's a lot of debate on that whole uncover his feet thing. So we'll just start out straightforward this morning. Naomi gives Ruth some pretty risky advice. And so there's a couple different commentators' ideas on what that means to uncover his feet. In the Hebrew, that word feet could mean feet or it could also mean male reproductive organ. So it's this awkward, like, what is Naomi saying here? So as we dig in, Naomi's given Ruth some pretty scandalous, pretty forward advice here. You notice in verse 3, this idea of, she's basically saying, clean yourself up and look nice, smell nice. Boaz has only seen you in work mode so far. But clean yourself up and let Boaz see you cleaned up a little bit. In verse 4, we see this idea, where is he going to be? Verse 3, verse 2, 3, 4. So he's going to be over there by the threshing floor. Just to give you a little picture of what this looks like, I pulled up this. So this is the idea of a threshing floor. Oftentimes it would be on top of a hill. If you do get to go to Israel, you'll see this. They'd usually put it on top of a hill, because what they would do is they'd take the winnowing fork, throw it up in the air, and at the top of the hill where it's windiest, the wind would take the chaff, blow it away, and the heavier grain would fall to the ground. There's a couple different ways to do it. Here also they kind of show this idea of a threshing sledge, of crushing it and separating the wheat from the chaff.
Oh, sorry. No, finish your thought.
No, go for it. Jump in.
No, I was just thinking about the dating thing. And in this case, it looks like the woman is initiating the thing. And so, you know, Bradcock is the other side of it. So how does that all? That's like a problem. So.
Yeah.
No,
that's a great observation. Verse 5, I was gonna throw that out there and ask, what were your guys' thoughts on that idea of, you're going to see as we move forward, Ruth is going to initiate. And so I wanted to hear, you know, in our modern day context, your guys' thoughts on that. So, yeah, we'll get to that in just a minute. So this is just to give you a little picture of a threshing floor. What they would have done is, after or during the harvest, they would have slept near it, the men who were working towards the harvest, to protect it. And so Naomi is telling Ruth, this is where Boaz is going to be spending the night. I want you to go where he's laying down, uncover his feet, whatever that means. And then this idea. So I want to hear, Stephen, that's a good observation. It seems like Naomi is telling Ruth, I want you to make your intentions very clear with Boaz as the time of the harvest is coming to an end. What do you guys think about that? You guys covered Song of Solomon with Brad, correct? This idea of men accepting responsibility, right? Stepping up, being clear, being intentional. What are your thoughts here as you see Naomi give Ruth advice to initiate the relationship?
I feel like it's a different situation. She's a widow.
Mm-hmm. We know later that Boaz has a closer next of kin, mm-hmm. So Boaz might not have realized that he should have been the kinsman redeemer in this case.
Mm-hmm. Spoiler alert. Yeah, like I said, I already ruined it in the first 5 minutes by showing the video, but you had a thought over here.
Oh, I was just, both of what they said, like, comes down to context.
I
think they had a big age difference too, mm-hmm. So like, just giving that green light.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I would argue that even though they're not into the relationship like we were talking about in chapter 2, how Boaz goes about like kind of providing and leading for her there is not like not necessarily that they're in a dating context, but it's not that he's passive or skipping away from that. In all reality, he probably wasn't even thinking or worried about that, so I would just look at it as she's just showing, hey, there is interest,
mm-hmm.
And I would go that route.
Because he's at that spot where he feels like, I'm too old, she's too young, she wouldn't want to marry, a guy like me that's this age, so, yeah. I'm curious, in today's context, how would you guys feel about that? Would you feel right as a girl to approach a guy? As a guy, how would you respond to that? What do you think? In light of Song of Solomon, and then now up next to Ruth, what are your thoughts? Yeah.
I think that the context is super important, because it seems like try to marry her,
mm-hmm.
but and then it like says that she makes herself known, and I think what it means by that is like she reveals like who she is, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like he just says like, okay, I'll kind of save you or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I may be wrong. If you could,
I think. No, I think these are good go ahead.
I think that we are looking for some, like, perfect dating scenario to, like, give us this, just do A, B, C, D, and you'll have a great relationship, but in reality, like, everybody's different, so we can say, yeah, sure, that's great too, but really what dating relationship actually ends up, how Song of Solomon looked or how Song of Solomon's interpreted to look, it doesn't actually look like that.
It doesn't?
No.
Yeah.
Did
there are like chariots like and yeah, it doesn't look like that.
Well, even
yeah.
But even like put into to current times,
mm-hmm.
like dating just doesn't look like that, you know? And so it's we can strive for it to look like that, but
right.
I mean, it all ends up certain ways. You meet people in different contexts,
mm-hmm.
and you know, there's so many scenarios that come to create a relationship.
Right. I think that's the beauty of what you see in Ruth. I think that's a great observation, is you see, really, as we talk about living in a painful, suffering, chaotic world, you see things aren't necessarily according to God's original plan and design, and yet you see God's hand in the details working it out. And so I think that's a great observation of, it's not always going to play out exactly like we want or exactly how it would in a perfect utopian world. But what we can learn from Ruth and Boaz and Song of Solomon is this idea of what was the character of the men we see? What was the character of the women we see? How did they approach this idea of initiating a relationship together in humility and seeking the Lord in it? So I think those are really good observations of saying, yeah, it's not going to be this A, B, C, you know, 1, 2, 3, perfect, exactly how we want it to be layout. But how is our character in the midst of that? Can it match these men and women as we look at them? Yeah, we had a thought over here.
Yeah. I think as far as like Song of Solomon and then also here in Ruth, I've just never like really seen it just seems kind of weird to look at it through like the dating lens, especially
mm-hmm.
because of this part where she's like uncovering his feet and like, like if I'm taking that as an example, then it just looks really sketchy.
Yeah.
You know? And the same thing with Song of Solomon. Like if I'm taking that literally as an example of like how a guy and a girl are supposed to interact, it's just, it gets really sketchy. And so like, I just, like on the other hand, like if you take it in the context of like looking forward into the church and like he's the Goel, you know,
mm-hmm.
the kinsman redeemer as Christ, and it just makes a little bit more sense, and like you don't have to go through those whole weird like, oh, she uncovered his feet, so like is she pursuing him, blah blah blah.
Right. Yeah, like how literally do you want to take this? Obviously, like I said, it can get sketchy quick. Absolutely. So I'm with you. That's a good observation. It's good thoughts. I love ultimately where you're going with that as we head towards the end. I mean, we're looking at Christ in the church, and what a beautiful picture. And so another spoiler alert, but that's where we're headed. All right. So verse 5, what do you see in Ruth's character? We've talked a lot about Boaz, a lot about Ruth, the different things that we've seen, and then what do you see in her response to Naomi's somewhat scandalous advice? What do you see?
I believe it's called loyalty.
Yeah, loyalty, right? What did Ruth's name mean?
Obey.
Obey.
No, sorry.
Yeah.
Just push over.
No, why can you
yeah,
hear
this,
me?
This table set up today, there's just way too much. Yeah. What do you... What does Ruth's name mean?
Friend
or companion. This idea we saw of loyalty. We see also, yeah, obedience. I don't know what was said back there, but yes, obedience. This idea of like, you know what? I trust my mother-in-law. And I said, what? This goes back to her statement in 1:16 where she says, I'll go where you go. Your God will be my God. And right here, you see in Ruth's character, her following through on her promise. Naomi, you, this is your advice for me. I'm going to follow. I'm going to obey. Can you imagine how scary this could be for Ruth? I mean, this is her. I mean, she is absolutely going out on a limb at this point. Because she could easily be, what do you think she's feeling right now? She could be feeling, man, I'm a Moabite. I'm from a pagan country. I'm a widow, which was difficult. I mean, extremely difficult to be remarried in that culture. I'm poor. I have nothing to offer. Why would Boaz be interested in me? And yet she says, all right, my mother-in-law asked me to be obedient, and both of our lives are kind of on the line. I'm going to go out on a limb, and I'm going to be faithful, and I'm going to respond. So just another beautiful thing you see in Ruth's character there. She's going to, yeah.
If the context could be taken as, like, instead of uncovering his feet, uncovering his genital area,
mm-hmm.
she's basically saying, okay, I will go, like, sleep with him.
Mm-hmm.
Because you not necessarily just told me to, but kind of, right?
I guess, and that's where it gets really tricky of, like you're saying, it gets really sketchy of, like, what exactly is Naomi saying here? And we're going to get there in a minute of what exactly, typically what happened and went down at the threshing floor, which I think will make a little more sense when we talk about it. But it's still, it's like, I'm still even having the opportunity to teach this, wrestling through exactly what was Naomi saying here. So let's keep working through it and see if it brings a little more sense to what Naomi's saying. But I'll show my cards a little bit and say, I'm not completely sure what Naomi is, where she's going with that. Somebody pick up 6 through 13.
Went down to the threshing floor and did according to all her mother-in-law had commanded her. When Boaz had eaten and drunk, and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain, and she came secretly and uncovered his feet and lay down. It happened in the middle of the night that the man was startled and bent forward, and behold, a woman was lying at his feet. He said, "Who are you?" And she answered, "I am Ruth, your maid. So spread your covering over your maid, for you are a close relative." Then he said, "May you be blessed of the Lord, my daughter. You have shown your last kindness to be better than the first by not going after young men, whether poor or rich. Now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you whatever you ask, for all my people in the city know that you are a woman of excellence. Now, it is true I am a close relative. However, there is a relative closer than I. Remain this night, and when morning comes, if he will redeem you, good. Let him redeem you. But if he does not wish to redeem you, then I will redeem you as the Lord lives. Lie down until morning."
Awesome, thanks. So what does that, so Ruth goes into the threshing floor, she does as Naomi says, and then in verse 9, does that ring a bell, what she says in verse 9? Does that connect back to anything we remember talking about? Humility, yeah.
Which part?
But a specific, so verse 9, she says, "I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your wings over your servant, for you are a redeemer." We saw this idea of spread your wings earlier in the book. Where did we see that?
In relation to Naomi, Ruth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 2:12. Somebody read that for us.
"The Lord will pay you for what you have done, and a full reward be given to you by the Lord, the God of Israel, whose wings you have come to take refuge."
Awesome. So this was, if you remember right, this was Boaz back when he first met Ruth, and he prays this prayer of blessing over her, of saying, man, it seems like the Lord's hand is upon you. I pray that he would continue to lead you, to guide you, to care for you, to provide for you, was Boaz's prayer for Ruth. And now we talked about it, how cool it was as we look forward, that God was going to take that righteous prayer of Boaz, and he was going to actually use Boaz to answer his own prayer. And so now here we see this idea, Ruth, in chapter 3, verse 9, uses that same language of, would you be the one that the Lord would use to provide for me? So essentially what Ruth is saying is, would you cover me? Would you bring us into your family and continue our family line? And so basically, Ruth is saying, show me you're interested as well. Would you provide security for me and my family? This idea of covering is just such a beautiful picture of how God covers us. You guys remember in Genesis 3, what was God's first, how did God respond to Adam and Eve when they sinned in the garden and rebelled against him and chose to follow the ways of Satan instead of God? What did God do?
He went to them.
Mm-hmm. He went to them, he asked them. Then he lays out, you see God lay out, now these are the consequences, here's how death is now entered. Do you remember all the way back, Genesis 3:21, what God did?
He covered him with fig leaves.
Yeah, what did he cover him with?
That animal skin.
Animal skin. So you see this, like, this beautiful picture. So Adam and Eve, after they sin, they're hiding in their guilt, their shame. They try and cover themselves with fig leaves. God comes to them, and he kills what we would assume is an innocent animal or two on their behalf, and he covers their nakedness, their shame, their guilt with the covering of an animal. And so you see, this is God's heart, is that in our guilt and our shame, God wants to cover us. He wants to care for us. And so this idea of spread your wings is just a beautiful picture of how God really, in our shame and our sin, wants to cover us, ultimately pointing forward to Christ, where we're headed. What do you see in Boaz's response? How does he respond? Essentially, Ruth is saying, I'm not asking you to marry me, but if you ask me to marry you, I will. It's essentially what Ruth is saying here. What do you see in his response? First tips. Yeah. What do we know about kinsmen redeemers? You guys looked a little bit at that with Mike, I'm sure, in Leviticus. What do we know about a kinsmen redeemer?
They're in a sense commanded to take care of a widow that's related.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we see this idea of this close relative, this kinsman redeemer, had the right to redeem people, property, etc. There were three things. The kinsman redeemer was they had to have in order to redeem. So they had to have the ability to carry on the family line, the family name. They had to be financially stable enough to buy the land. And then lastly, the desire to marry. And so we see that Boaz has all three of these. And now he's going to go to a guy, and we'll see if he has all three of those as well, because he's, as you said, first dibs, first in line. Yeah, Janelle?
Can you repeat this?
Yeah, so first of all, has to have the ability to carry on the family line, keep the family name going. Secondly, he has to be financially stable enough to buy land, to redeem. Third, he has to have the desire to marry.
So he has to be on the husband's side of the family?
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah, to carry on that name, from what I understand. But I'd have to look into that. That's a good question. You'll see that if you want to go back on your own time, look through Leviticus 25. It walks through a lot of the idea of redeeming property and people, that kinsman redeemer. All right, so let's see now as they wrap up at the threshing floor, verse 14 through 18. Somebody pick up there.
So she lay at his feet until the morning. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Until you learn how the matter turns out, for the man will not rest, but the setter is
and things. So in 14, so it's still dark, what does Boaz say? So what's he doing? Is he being shady?
Protecting her dignity.
Protecting her dignity, protecting her reputation. So let me turn to Hosea chapter 9, verses 1. Hosea 9, 1. When you're there, go ahead and read it. I know, it's one of those super easy to find books, huh? That's why I love the laptop.
Do not rejoice, O Israel. Do not be jubilant like the other nations. For you have been unfaithful to your God. You love the wages of a prostitute at every threshing floor.
So there's a couple different passages in the Old Testament. This is one of them that shows this idea of at the threshing floor, a lot of the men would hire prostitutes to keep them company while they're protecting their grain. So during the harvest, it was just kind of a free-for-all. We're sleeping out here. We're protecting our grain. A lot of the men would hire prostitutes. So this is the context. The idea that Ruth is stepping into is it was almost expected that you're at the threshing floor and prostitutes come in and sleep with the men to keep them company. And Boaz here in this context wants very clearly to protect her reputation and her dignity from people thinking that of her, that she's just a Moabite prostitute that came in to keep Boaz company during the barley harvest. And so you see this idea once again of Boaz protecting her dignity, her reputation. Then in 15, what do you see? What does he say there?
Fifteen.
Somebody read 15.
And he said, "Bring the garment you're wearing and hold it out." So she held it, and he measured out 6 measures of barley and put it on her. Then she went into the city.
So Boaz provides kind of what we would call a down payment of saying, here's some food. Now, this is a down payment for you. You've seen Boaz be generous. We talked about that. That's one of the characteristics we've really seen stand out in Boaz is how generous he is. And now he's saying, I'm going to follow through on this. It's a little funny, but I heard it in a sermon and I thought it was well put. Basically, what Boaz is doing here is the seed to fill the stomach was a promise of the seed to fill the womb. And so what Boaz is basically saying, here's some food. Here's a down payment of how I'm going to care for you. But also, if the Lord wills, I want to care for you and I want to continue your family line as well. So you see this kind of sign and a seal of he's going to be good on his word. Then you see verse 18, what is Naomi's picture of Boaz and his character? What does she say? Somebody read that.
And she said, "Sit still, my daughter, until you know how the matter will turn out, for the man will not rest until he has concluded the matter this day."
So what do you see in Boaz's character according to Naomi? He's a man who will follow through. That's huge. I was thinking about this just from my context. I've had the opportunity to work with a lot of people, and especially in ministry. One of the biggest things, especially in church planning, is there's just so many details to take care of. And after a Sunday, there's so many conversations you've had and different things that you're like, okay, I got to get to this. There is nothing better than having someone on your team that you can trust that when they say they're going to do something, they're going to do it. And I've experienced both. I've worked beside people who all right, I'll take care of that, and I could have it off my mind completely, and I could go do what I need to get done, and I know they're going to get done what they just said they would. But then I've also worked beside people who I'll have to remind them again and again, and, hey, have you taken care of that yet? Oh, no, not yet, forgot. And, hey, we're human, we're going to make that mistake. But I'll be honest, for me, that's one of the biggest character traits when it comes to work ethic. And for me, I think as I, Lord willing, get to continue in ministry and have the opportunity to hire more people beside me, one of the biggest things I would look for in hiring someone is, do they have the ability to follow through? Do they have that character of Boaz, someone who is going to say, yeah, I've got that, and I can have it completely off my mind, and they're going to take it and run with it. So you see this idea of, can you, as in your workplace, can your boss trust that when you say, I've got that, you're going to follow through and commit on that? Really awesome that Naomi and we're even going to see those around Boaz know that when Boaz says he's going to do something, he's going to do it. All right, let's jump into 4. We're doing well. We're making a good pace here. So here in 4, we're going to see this idea of, if you remember in the video, the reversal of tragedies. So chapter 1, we saw all these things that hit Naomi right out of the gate, and now we're going to see God's hand begin to work out in the details in this reversal of tragedies in 4. Somebody pick up and read through verse 6 for us. Where did you wrap up there? Sorry.
You know, I ended at 4. Did you want 5?
Yeah, go through 6, please. Thanks.
Oh, okay. And Boaz said, on the day you buy the field from the land hand of Naomi, you must also acquire Ruth the Moabite, the widows of the deceased, in order to raise up the name of the deceased on his inheritance. The closest relative said, I cannot redeem it for myself because I would jeopardize my own inheritance. Redeem it for yourself. You may have my right of redemption.
Awesome, thanks. So this is a big moment in the story. All right, so as they leave the threshing floor, Ruth goes home with a promise from Boaz that he's going to be good on his word. He's going to do everything he can in his power to make this happen, to redeem her as the kinsman redeemer. But there's one obstacle in the way. There's one who is closer, the one who's got first dibs, as we said. And so this is the final obstacle to work through. And so he goes to the city gate. What do we know about the city gate? As you guys have worked through some of the Old Testament, what have you learned about the gate of the city?
It's where the leaders are.
It's where the leaders are. It's where business happens. It's where deals go down and covenants are made. And, you see kind of the elders of the city gather there. They discuss the matters of the city and where business transpires. So Boaz goes to the city gate. He finds this guy. What's this guy's name?
We don't know, huh?
Yeah, trick question. So it seems like the author is basically like, this guy's name isn't even really worth mentioning. He's just, Boaz calls him friend, and he remains nameless in this story. So he grabs this first kinsman redeemer, and then he grabs, who else does he bring with him? Yeah, he grabs the elders of the city as witnesses. Says, all right, I want you guys to see what's about to happen right here as I have this conversation with the kinsman redeemer. That way, after the conversation is had, the deal is made, there are witnesses that are present. So now you know this is an official business deal. It's going to happen. What do you notice in the way, the approach, I guess you could say, that Boaz takes? How does he go about this conversation? Stephen, I know you're a businessman, right? I know we've got a few entrepreneurs in here. What do you notice about Boaz in how he approaches this conversation.
He doesn't get right down to it at first.
Okay.
Tries to sell him a field first.
Yeah. What else do you see? I mean, yeah, I like that. Even backing up a little further, he wants to go about it the right way, which is good to see. He wants the elders there. He doesn't want to try and manipulate or trick. Like, he has the witnesses there, the elders there. But in his actual conversation, the way he brings it up to this friend, to this kinsman redeemer who's nameless, how does he do that? I think it was kind of said here, is he doesn't go straight to the point, but one way is he starts with the kind of the appealing part, the land. You see the immediate reaction is the kinsman redeemer reacts and says, I'd love that land. You see the business part of this kinsman redeemer. He'll take the land. But then what you notice is, not in a manipulative way, hopefully, Boaz paints kind of this bad picture financially of having to marry Ruth. So this idea of, somebody turn, actually let's all turn to Genesis 38. We already started awkward, so what's another awkward story this morning? Genesis 38, 6 through 11. When you get there, somebody read that for us. 38, 6 through 11.
And Judah took a wife for his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Judah's firstborn was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord put him to death. Then Judah said to Onan, go into your brother's wife and perform the duty of a brother-in-law to her, and raise up offspring for your brother. But Onan knew that the offspring would not be his, so whenever he went into his brother's wife, he would waste the semen on the ground, so as not to give offspring to his brother. And what he did was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and he put him to death also. Then Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, remain a widow in your father's house till Shelah, my son, grows up. For he feared that he would die like his brother. So Tamar went and remained in her father's house.
So in this story, back in Genesis 38, which we'll return to as we wrap up the book of Ruth, you have Tamar, the daughter-in-law of Judah. And the first son she marries, doesn't give us a whole lot of background, but evidently he was wicked and the Lord just took him away. And so then the brother needs to step up as a kinsman redeemer and provide for her, provide a child and take on the land, all that. Why do you think he was so stubborn or obstinate or unwilling to do that as a kinsman redeemer? Yeah, yeah, it's interesting. So if he were to have a male child through her, he knows that when that male child grows up, that child will receive the inheritance. So he'll end up losing the land and all that comes with it if he, in a sense, gives her a child. And so Onan is reluctant to provide for her because he knows, child grows up, I'm going to lose it all. So financially, through a business mindset, it's a bad decision to make, and he knows that. And God wasn't so pleased with his reluctance to provide and to redeem her. And so here we see this other friend, back in the story of Ruth, this kinsman redeemer, is he wanted the land. Yeah, I'll take the land, but if I take Ruth the Moabite and have a child with her, and he's a male child, he's going to grow up, he's going to take the land and all that comes with it, and I'm left without. So it's just not a good business deal. And that's the lens that this guy is thinking through. Going back to this idea of Boaz, the way he words things, I was just noticing how important words can be and how we frame things and in the context in which we share things. My wife and I are doing some premarital counseling with a few different couples, and we really enjoy doing that together. And one thing I keep noticing, one of the most important things in marriage, we hear it a lot, is communication. This idea of how we share what we're trying to share. And so one thing we've really been picking up on is just how can we, first for our marriage, really work on that and grow in that, but then walk beside couples and help them understand how you say things has huge implications on your relationship. And one of the things we've noticed with one couple in particular is, for example, the fiance will share something like she's had a really busy, stressful day, and she just says, "I need to be alone right now." And what she means by that is, I'm tired. It's been a stressful day. I just want to spend some time by myself to kind of recharge. But the guy has had some difficult relationships in the past, and what he hears when she says, "I want to be alone," is our relationship is nearly over. Like, that's what he hears when she communicates that, is, all right, you want to be alone, you don't want to be around me, and he feels this distance in the relationship, where she feels the relationship's fine, she just needs some time alone. And so just for us, we've been recognizing how can we kind of help them understand and think through the way you frame things, the way you communicate has huge implications on your relationship, really in so many areas of life. So how can she, in a way, say, "Hey, we're fine. Our relationship's good. I've just had a tough day. I'd like to spend some time alone to recharge," so that he doesn't feel panicked when she says, "I want to be alone," meaning I don't want to be around you, but instead he can understand, "Hey, we're good, but she just needs some time to recharge." So I just am really impressed as I look at Boaz, even though this isn't a relationship or a marriage context, he thinks through what he's going to say and how he's going to say it, and the impact it's going to have. Now, with that, somebody pick up at verse 7 and take through 12. 7 through 12.
"Now, this was the custom in the former times in Israel concerning redeeming and exchanging. To confirm anything, one man took off his sandal and gave it to the other, and this was the confirmation of Israel. Therefore, the close relative said to Boaz, 'Buy it for yourself.' So he took off his sandal, and Boaz said to the elders and all the people, 'You are witnesses this day that I have bought all that was Elimelech's and all that was Shilon's and Melon's from the hand of Naomi. Moreover, Ruth the Moabitess, the widow of Melon, I have acquired as my wife to perpetuate the name of the family through his inheritance, that the name of the dead may not be cut off from among his brethren and from his position at the gate. You are witnesses to this day.'" You said through 12?
Yeah.
And all the people who were at the gate and the elders said, "We are witnesses. And the Lord made the Lord make the woman who you are coming to your house like Rachel and Leah, the two who built the house of Israel, and may you prosper in Ephrathah, and be famous in Bethlehem. May your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah, because of the offspring which the Lord will give you from this young woman."
Awesome, thanks. So this other redeemer says, "No, it's not a good business deal. I'm not interested." Boaz says, "Fine, then I'll take her. I want to marry her. I want to take the land." And then so they need to seal the deal. They need to, in front of the witnesses. How do they do that? What do they do?
Change their footwear.
What's that?
Just change footwear.
Yeah, exactly. Here's my rainbow flip-flop right here for you. This idea, I was like, man, what's with the sandal? The sandal could represent the idea of walking the land. You guys remember, probably with Abraham, Mike covered this with you guys. What are some different ways in ancient Near East, near, I can say that, I think, I hope, Near Eastern culture? The struggle is real this morning. What are ways they would claim the land?
To walk it up and down.
walk it. There are a couple other ways. They could plant a tree, dig a well. I think we've talked about that. So the thinking here could be, one of the ideas is the sandal represents the idea of walking the land. So, okay, this land, here's my sandal. Now, why they, so it's our equivalent of a handshake or a contract. This is now yours. The land's yours. Walk it. It's all yours. What do you notice in verse 11 and 12 about how the people at the gate, the elders, what do they think of Boaz? Yeah, seems pretty evident that the elders, those in the city, hold Boaz in really high regard. They really respect him. Boaz has a city known, well-wide known reputation. And just going back to the relationships thing, this something I was thinking about is when you're in a new relationship or your relationship is becoming more serious, what do your friends and family think? Are they quiet, or are they excited for you? Are they lying to you? Have you ever noticed, there's a few friends of mine, not to pick on them too much, they'll remain anonymous, but it's hard to really root for their relationship because you're just not sure that it's the best or the godliest fit. And so at the same time, you want to be a good friend, you want to support them, but it's hard to be overly excited for them. And so that's a great sign when you're dating or you're moving towards a more serious relationship. What are your friends and your family, those closest to you, are they excited for you? Do they like what they see, or are they nervous for you? You see here in 11 and 12, the people of the city are so, they're excited for Boaz. They're excited for Ruth. They say, look at what the Lord is doing. Look at what God is going to do through you guys. And that would be my hope for really each of our relationships, that your friends and your family are on the sidelines cheering you on. Like, this is something we want to see. We want to see, we see two godly people that God's been using in their own lives. Now bringing them together, imagine what more God is going to continue to do. So just more encouragement. What a great sign to know that your friends and family are there rooting for you and they like what they see. All right. So now we head towards the wrap up here. Somebody take verse 13 through the end of the chapter for us.
So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife, and he went into her, and the Lord gave her conception for a son. Then the woman said to Naomi, "Blessed be the Lord, who has not left you this day without a redeemer, and may his name be renowned in Israel. He shall be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age. For your daughter-in-law who loves you, who is more to you than seven sons, has given birth to him." Then Naomi took the child and lay him on her lap and became his nurse. And the woman of the neighborhood gave him a name, saying, "A son has been born to Naomi." They named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. Now, these are the generations of Perez. Perez fathered Hezron. Hezron fathered Ram. Ram fathered Aminadab. Aminadab fathered Nahshon. Nahshon fathered Salmon. Salmon fathered Boaz. Boaz fathered Obed. Obed fathered Jesse. And Jesse fathered David.
Awesome. And that's how it ends. You notice in verse 13, the Lord gave her conception and she bore a son. It has this idea of it's a gift from God. God gives her the ability to bear a child. Do you remember back in chapter 1 how long it seems that Ruth and her sister Orpah were without children?
10 years.
And so their wombs were closed. Ruth's was closed, we can assume, for 10, 11 years now. And now we see God bless her and open her womb so that she can conceive a son. And just thinking by way of application, how many things do we assume that we deserve, and yet when we don't get them, we feel entitled, like, man, I should have this. And I love the language that the author here, Ruth, uses of God gave her. What a gift. I think oftentimes we just assume that we should be healthy. We assume that we've got our friends and our family. But then when we lose a close friend or a family member or our health is taken away, we kind of react and say, why is this being taken away from me? When really it was a gift to begin with. And so began just for me thinking through seeing those things as a gift, not as something to be expected. And you can imagine how thankful, and we've seen in Ruth this humility and this thankfulness, how thankful she must have been that God gave her this gift of a son. Just incredible to see that. So she has a son by the name of Obed, which means servant of Yahweh. As we talked about Ruth, names are significant. The meaning of names are incredible. So it means servant of Yahweh or worshiper. It's interesting that verse 17, the women of the neighborhood gave him a name. I wonder, you know, I don't have an answer for this, but I wonder if it's like the whole village chooses the name of your child. I was just thinking that could get interesting. You know, it's hard enough when you let too much of your family in on the decision for that one, I imagine. But then you got all the women in the neighborhood talking about what they're going to name your child. But they name him Obed, servant of Yahweh or worshiper. We see this idea of he's going to be the grandfather of David. So you guys are studying David with Mike right now. And Boaz is the great-grandfather of David. We see just so many incredible things. So if you think about it, King David's grandmother is a Moabite woman. You think about that as you study David. That's amazing. If we had the time, we would take a look at Matthew 1 and walk through the different genealogy that you see. And you see this idea of three sets of 14 generations that Matthew starts his gospel with. He goes from Abraham to David, from David to the deportation, from the deportation to Jesus. And you see these generations. But what's significant in that, and I'll pull up this map so you can take a look at it too, just to give you a visual. If you can see it. You guys see that all right? So this is David's ancestry from Abraham. Yeah. Will it work? You know this is going to be a struggle. It is real. Yeah. You can do it. Rotate. Is that going to work? No. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Hold on. Is it going to flip with me, though?
No,
it
won't.
It'll go the other way.
It won't go the other way.
Oh. It won't? We'll go.
We'll turn around.
All right, everybody, flip upside down to a handstand. All right. We'll just do it two more times. This is going to work, right? There we go. All right.
Small victories.
Yeah, it's the little things in life. All right. Where were we? We were talking, genealogy. The most exciting stuff in Scripture. All right, so Abraham to Isaac to Jacob to Judah to Perez to Hezron, Ram, Amminadab, Nahshon, Salmon, Boaz, Obed, Jesse, David. What's amazing, if you were to spend some time in Matthew 1, is Matthew starts his gospel writing with a Jewish audience in mind to show how Jesus is king, how Jesus is the promised one, who all the way back from Genesis 3:15, but if you remember what did God say in Genesis 3:15? This idea of the first gospel. Proto-Evangelion. What was God's promise?
That his heel would be bitten, but he would crush the head of his enemy.
Yeah, so immediately we talked about God comes and he covers the guilt and the shame of Adam and Eve. But not only that, he promises that he will send one. He will send this Redeemer to crush the head of the serpent, to crush sin and death. He's going to send Jesus. And so from Genesis all the way to Matthew, we see how God is working out his plan, this beautiful plan, to from the seed of Adam and Eve all the way to Jesus, how God maintains that line. And a huge part of that line we're going to see from Abraham all the way to David. And so it's just beautiful to see. And what Matthew does in chapter 1 is he lists five women. He lists Tamar, Rahab, Ruth, Bathsheba, and Mary. So in Matthew 1, he lays out those five women. What's amazing is, if you think about each of these women, so Tamar, if you remember in Genesis 38, we talked a little bit about that, but if you were to continue to read that story, she was the daughter-in-law of Judah, so she married Judah's two sons, didn't work out. So what she does, she dresses herself as a prostitute and tricks her father-in-law into sleeping with her. So, yeah, you talk sketchy, we got sketchy there. But she has twins, and one of those twins is Perez, wherever he is, right there. So, son of Judah. And we know as Judah is the line of the kings, the line of Christ. So Jesus comes from the line of Judah. And so you have Tamar is one of the women that Matthew lists out. And then Rahab. Well, Rahab, if you look in the book of Joshua, is often called a prostitute. Rahab the prostitute lies to the guards to protect, ultimately, we debated over this a few months ago, but to protect these two Jewish spies. And God uses her in the line as well. If you go to, somebody turn to Matthew 1:5. Matthew 1:5. Read that when you get a chance.
Salmon begot Boaz by Rahab. Boaz begot Obed by Ruth, and Obed begot Jesse, and Jesse begot David the king.
So God then uses the prostitute Rahab so that Boaz could come from her line. So you see this beautiful thing, the way God is bringing together Moabites, prostitutes. Now, you know, we've got obviously the story of Ruth. You guys are about to get into the story of the fourth woman, Bathsheba, who is mentioned as well. And spoiler alert, you know how that's going to go, how that is initiated. And then Mary, a pregnant teenager. And so this idea of just the, really in many ways, the scandalous nature of the gospel and how God uses people that we wouldn't expect, people who are... in many ways have had a crooked past or a difficult past or a hard past, and God will use them to bring something absolutely beautiful. So all the way from Genesis 3:15 all the way forward to the promise of Christ, the one who will come and crush the head of the serpent. So it's beautiful the way that the author of Ruth wraps this up, showing this genealogy all the way from Abraham to David to Jesus. And so as we close, I just had three observations of application for us as we look at the book of Ruth. The first one is this idea of what we learn from the book of Ruth is just how we see that the provident hand of God amidst ordinary and even painful times in life. So we see God's hand in really these difficult times. In Ruth, we saw travels, we saw marriages, we saw deaths, we saw harvesting, we saw eating, sleeping, purchasing land, and yet we see this beautiful whole work of God as we end the book of Ruth. And so early on when we first started, we read this quote from C.S. Lewis saying, when we hit hard times, when we hit difficult times, the natural human reaction is to begin to ask this question. C.S. Lewis says, if God were good, he would wish to make his creatures perfectly happy. And if God were almighty, he would be able to do what he wished. But the creatures are not happy. Therefore, God lacks either goodness or power or both. This is the problem of pain in its simplest form. So as we talked about Naomi, as she was forced to move away from her homeland, from all that was familiar, as she lost her husband, her sons, as she was hungry, she was begin asking these questions, where is God in this? Does God even care? Is God good? Can I trust him? Is God in control? And so C.S. Lewis boiled down this idea of when we're in our pain, we begin to ask those two questions. But the book of Ruth, as we wrap it up, shows us that God is both good and he is powerful. And so when we are in our heaviest and darkest and hardest times of life, what gets us through is remembering and believing that God is both good and powerful. He's in control, whether it feels like it or not, because we know that his hand is in the details. The second point, second observation, we tend to learn much more about God in suffering than in success. We see this in the book of Ruth. We tend to learn much more about God in suffering than success. I've become more and more amazed as I get to be a pastor and how much I sit down with people week in and week out, and I hear how much pain and hurt people have been through. You know, you interact with people on a surface level, even on a Sunday. Things are quick. You see, okay, how you doing? Good week. Okay, how was work? Okay, good. And then when you actually sit down and you have the time to hear a little bit about their lives, I'm always amazed at how much each of us have gone through. But each time that these stories are shared, I'm amazed at how the hardest times often become the highlights of people's lives. They're hard. They hurt. But it was during that time that they began to realize just how close God was to them and with them in that time of difficulty. And so Ruth, you look at this idea, chapter 1, Naomi is thinking, where is God in this? He's abandoned me. She even calls herself Mara, bitter. God's hand is against me is what she's feeling. But by chapter 4, I imagine Naomi is realizing, God has been with me the whole time. God has been good the whole time. God's been in control the whole time. And so Naomi, I imagine after this story, probably felt and realized that God was closer to her than she ever realized. The last thing, last point of application as we wrapped up, as we talked about this genealogy, I'm sure many of you have heard this line, this idea of God uses crooked sticks to make straight lines. It's amazing to me to see how God will take those who feel like they are undeserving, those who have a crooked past, those who feel like, man, God couldn't use me because I did this, or I'm struggling with this, and yet God wants to take those who recognize that they aren't worthy to be used by him. He wants to take them and use them in a mighty way. So you may feel like, man, I've got a crooked past, or I'm stuck in a crooked way, but God wants to use you to make a straight line. It's just beautiful to see. We talked a little bit about the humility of Ruth and Boaz. We went to James 4 and how God opposes the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. So God is basically saying, if you're proud and you think you're worthy to be used by me, I'm going to humble you. I'm going to break you down until you recognize that, as he says in 1 Corinthians 1, I'm going to use the foolish to shame the wise. I'm going to use the weak to shame the strong. But if you're humble, if you recognize, man, I'm not worthy. If you're like Boaz, you're like, I'm too old. There's no way she'd want to marry me. Or Ruth, I'm a Moabite woman. I'm a widow. I have nothing to offer. There's no way he would want to marry me. And you see what God does with that sort of humility and how they are a huge part of the story of Jesus. So as we close, I wanted to, in many ways, I debated. I was like, it's kind of corny, but I'm going to end with it anyway. Many of you, are familiar with the poem Footprints in the Sand. So I wanted to read that for us and with the Book of Ruth in mind, recognize in many ways, in the story of Naomi especially, this is where God was.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
So when it says Naomi became Obed's nurse, what does that mean?
Yeah, I'm not sure what it means by became his nurse. I looked into it a little bit. It looked, you know, at this idea of just like she's his grandmother, right? But there's just this closeness, this bond of like almost treating him as her own son because she had lost her two sons. So like she nursed him, she brought him up. So almost in a sense, like she was another mother to him. Is the closest I could get to really understanding that.
So we don't know if she actually nursed him.
Yeah, I don't know. It didn't get.
Is that possible?
I'm not sure. That's a good question. If you find that, let me know. But I didn't see anything along those lines. It seemed more so to be the closeness of the bond, but it could have been. If anybody has a note on that, I'm up for hearing it, but I'm not sure. So I want to read this to us with Ruth and Naomi in mind, and then I'll ask if you guys have any more questions or thoughts. I'd love to pray and then bring Eric up for a minute if he's up for it, and just kind of close with this idea of providence and where is God in the details, and we'll call it a day. All right, footprints in the sand. One night I dreamed a dream as I was walking along the beach with my Lord. Across the dark sky flashed scenes from my life. For each scene, I noticed two sets of footprints in the sand, one belonging to me and one to the Lord. After the last scene of my life flashed before me, I looked back at the footprints in the sand. I noticed that at many times along the path of life, especially at the very lowest and saddest times, there was only one set of footprints. This really troubled me, so I asked the Lord about it. Lord, you said once I decided to follow you, you'd walk with me all the way. But I noticed that during the saddest and most troublesome times of life, there was only one set of footprints. I don't understand why, when I needed you the most, you would leave me. He whispered, "My precious child, I love you and will never leave you. Never, ever during your trials and testings. When you saw only one set of footprints, it was then that I carried you." And so this idea of, as we look at Naomi, and in chapter 1, she was in a spot where she was feeling like, where are you, God? Where are you in the details? I feel abandoned. I feel bitter. I feel like your hand is against me. And then we get to chapter 4, and then we see that God was with her the entire way, that God was walking through it with her. So my hope for us, my prayer, is that as we have the Book of Ruth in mind, we would remember and think back to the Book of Ruth in some of the toughest of our times and realize when God feels the farthest away from us, in many ways, he's the closest to us. He is with us. And what a beautiful picture of what God brings out of pain and hard times and how good he is, how powerful he is. So with that, let me pray for us. And I'd love to hear if you guys have any questions, thoughts, observations, and we'll bring Eric up. Let me pray. Father, thank you so much for your goodness. Thank you for the Book of Ruth and what a picture it is of your love for us. Jesus, the fact that we're a picture of Ruth. We're a picture of someone that needs to be redeemed, someone that is not worthy of your love, someone who is not worthy to be bought, and yet you were willing to buy us with your own precious blood. We're so thankful that Boaz is just a picture of how you are our greater redeemer. We're so thankful that you would buy us and love us and care for us and provide for us. We love you. In your name we pray. Amen. Amen, amen. Any thoughts, questions? Book of Ruth? Yeah.
This might be a stretch, but I'm curious. In Malachi, where it says the Son of Righteousness will come with healing in his wings, and then I think Mike was saying in Luke when the woman reaches out to the corner or the wing of his garment and like gets healing.
Hmm.
Is that kind of tying a parallel between Boaz and Jesus, or is that just a stretch?
That could be. I've never heard that before, but that is fascinating for sure. So, what was the Malachi passage?
I think it was Malachi 4. Yeah, Malachi 4:2. The son of righteousness comes with feeling in his wings.
There's a note in my Bible that says the wings part could be referred to as a garment, as the edges of a garment.
Yeah, yeah. Like a covering garment, yeah. That's an odd, if, I think that could be a great connection. It's a great picture. I never made that connection with she touches the corner of his garment, right? Yeah, that's good. I wish I had a definitive answer for you. I think it makes me want to go look into it more, though, so thank you. Malachi 4:2?
Yeah.
Is that right? Okay. Good. Any other thoughts, questions, anything unclear? Going once, twice, three times. Eric, you mind coming on up? Sharon. So I asked a couple months ago, you know, we had the, I'm going to go ahead and stop it here.